This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for listening to this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. We release a new episode every Thursday, so make sure you subscribe to receive them all. Today we're heading to the Isles of Scilly, a small cluster of islands off the tip of Cornwall in the southwest of England. Nowadays, this archipelago is treasured for its natural beauty and holiday charm. But in centuries past, they were on the front line of Britain's military defence. And it's that history that Senior Properties Curator for the West Region, Wyn Scutt.
Hello.
Along with visiting fellow at Bournemouth University and author of Defending Scilly, Dr. Alan Brodie.
Hello.
Join us now to talk about. Before we dive into their history, let's discuss the Isles of Scilly today, as I'm not sure all of our listeners will be familiar with them. How far out are the islands from the western tip of England, Wyn?
Surprisingly far, actually. 28 miles. It takes about 2 hours 45 minutes on the boat, so it is quite a distance. I think people often expect them to be sort of just a small jump from Penzance, but actually quite a long way. But you can fly, and you can by helicopter or by plane as well.
Okay, and where does one take the boat from? Is it Penzance?
It's the Cylonian from Penzance, yes, and that's the 2 hour 45 minute thing, which is a beautiful trip if the dolphins are jumping. That happened to me last time, just dolphins following the boat, which was amazing. The only trouble is, in a rough sea, it's a little bit unsettling, that particular boat.
And who provides the helicopter service?
Well, that's Penzance Helicopters from Penzance, from the heliport there. That's, I think, a 15-minute or something, very, very fast joined across to St. Mary's or Tresco. But, of course, as you'd expect, a little bit pricey.
And how many islands make up the Isles of Scilly? Because it's quite a few, isn't there?
Well, there's said to be about 140. It depends whether you call a rock an island or whatever. But there are 5 inhabited islands and about 140 little ones of varying sizes, but uninhabited, all those others.
And what are the bigger ones? I think you've mentioned a couple already, haven't you?
Well, St. Mary's and Tresco's are perhaps some of the best known, and today we'll be talking about those two particular islands. And there's an enormous amount to see. And you can usually get round St. Mary's in a day on a bike or a buggy or something like that, or even a car. But there's so much to see that you can actually spend a few days. Alan takes his holidays there regularly. So,
When you're talking about St. Mary's and Tresco, there are cars on the islands and roads, and you know, you can travel around.
St. Mary's, you can. It's nicer not to drive, to be honest. You know, if you can cycle or walk, there are beautiful walks, and it's very peaceful. There's very little traffic, and virtually no traffic on Tresco at all. It's like walking around a big garden. In fact, the Tresco Abbey gardens there are beautiful, but the whole island, they're like little paradises, actually. You know, when you fly in, there are these little silver-sanded, fringed little jewels in the sea, and they are absolutely enchanting. You just wouldn't feel that this was Britain, at least southern Britain anyway. They are absolutely enchanting.
This is the key attraction, isn't it? Especially for people who like to get a bit of extra sun. Alan, the climate is quite special on the Isles of Scilly, isn't it?
I think in a word, very pleasant, or two words, I should say, very pleasant. It's never too cold and it's never too hot. So in the middle of summer, if you have a heat wave on the mainland, because there's water all around the islands, the temperature is very, very pleasant indeed. You know, it never gets too hot. And in the winter, likewise, it never gets too cold. You very occasionally get snow, but it's a very, very small amount. And this means that you can have fantastic sort of semi-tropical plants there. And sometimes when you're there when the sun is out, which is often at times of the year when you wouldn't expect it on the mainland, it's like looking across at sort of Caribbean islands until you put your feet in the water.
Yeah. There's agapanthus and all sorts of, you know, quite exotic flowers that just grow in the hedgerows. You know, it's
stunning. Yeah, there are plants that you have as house plants on the mainland that grow outside. And you have huge aloe veras and amazing succulents that just simply wouldn't survive on the mainland because of the frost.
And does it get frosts then, the Isles of Scilly?
Almost none. Very rare.
Against this idyllic backdrop, we now need to talk about something really tough and hard and militaristic, and that is the heritage of the islands, the recent military heritage, which does go back a few hundred years. English Heritage look after as well some prehistoric sites. So what can you tell us about these sites, Wyn?
Well, those are prehistoric sites. They're sort of Neolithic Bronze Age period, so about 4,000 to 5,000 years old. And Bantskarn is a particularly nice one. You can actually climb into the chamber of this chambered tomb. And you can do the same at Inisigin, where there are two of these, and at Porthcawl as well. And as well as those Neolithic Bronze Age chambered tombs, all of which you can climb inside, and they're really interesting sites. You can also go to the ancient village, an Iron Age village at Halangi Down, and you can see the stone houses still surviving there. So it's a great place to look at prehistory as well. I'm more of a prehistorian, but I love the military stuff too. So you get a bit of yin and yang really going around the islands. You know, you get these two extremes of archaeology, which are absolutely wonderful.
Those sites, which islands are they on?
All our sites are on St. Mary's and Tresco. So most of these on St. Mary's, in fact.
So a couple of the biggest islands, basically.
Yeah. Indeed.
And were the Isles of Scilly ever invaded by foreign powers, Alan?
Thankfully, no. They prepared for this. But in fact, when the one invasion did come, it was from Britain during the Civil War.
So we're talking about the 1600s, that sort of period.
The 17th century, yeah, the 1600s.
And if the islands were never invaded, what threats must have been felt over the centuries?
Well, at different times, there were different enemies. So, you know, in the 16th and the 17th century, it was France and Spain because England had broken away from the Catholic Church. In the mid-17th century, there's the threat from the Dutch. The French remain a threat from the 16th century right through to the end of the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, of course, there's the threat from Germans. So Isles of Scilly have managed to cover, you know, basically every problem they could think of.
Why would they be strategically important in case of conflict? Because, as you say, they are, as Wyn said, about 28 miles off the southwestern tip of England, so quite far away for any invading force.
Well, the 28 miles is really important because what it does is it allows Britain, while it holds the islands, to extend its military reach out into the seas. So it means that ships were 28 miles further out into the sea to take on any enemy. And in the 20th century, aircraft were 28 miles further out into the sea. And the other key thing was that, of course, the islands, as Wyn said, the journey from the mainland to the Isles of Scilly can be interesting at rougher times of the sea. And what happens on the islands is that there's a small area of water in the middle of the islands called the Road and various other channels that are relatively calm. So if you stand on St. Mary's and you look out to sea, you can see giant sort of waves breaking. And then you turn and you look inside into the center of these group of islands, and it's wonderfully calm there. And it's a great place for ships to seek shelter and to operate from.
I see. So that's appealing for both a defensive force and an attacking force. If an attacking force ever landed, they'd have a good sort of position.
Yeah. And the islands are defensible because, as Wyn said, there are hundreds of rocks, so they're actually relatively difficult to get into. So, you know, naval-wise, they make quite a good defensive position, as well as, you know, providing you with a good sort of sheltered location from which to operate.
Yes. And of course, if you're defending the islands, hopefully your knowledge, your local knowledge, will be better than the enemy. So you'll know where the dangerous rocks are, etc.
Indeed, indeed, yes.
I understand, Alan. I think that because the winds tend to be south, coming from the southwest, from the Atlantic, that you have a strategic advantage by being further out up the channel towards the Atlantic to bear down on any enemy or whatever. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it means that because of where the islands are, you're the intersection of various bodies of water. So you're controlling quite a long way out into the English Channel. You're also controlling access into what the Celtic Sea and the Irish Channel up between Ireland and England. And this becomes very important when France is trying to arm the Scots and the Jacobites against the English in the 18th century. And so the position is really vital for sort of control of the waters around them.
We talked at the start about, obviously, the helicopter rides if you're feeling flush and want to have a holiday. But is there an aircraft landing field? Is there an airfield that, or the island's not built for that?
Well, there is. There's St. Mary's Airport, which is the main place that you can land. Now, that begins life as a civil airport in the, I think it's about 1937. It then, during the Second World War, is home to a squadron of six Hurricanes. And I always think if you're going to be a fighter pilot, it must have been one of the great places to be sent in the Second World War, because you'd go up each day and just look for any enemy activity, although rarely did they actually manage to encounter the enemy. And there's still that airfield has went back to being, you know, St. Mary's Airport. You can also land a helicopter on Tresco, and that's where the helicopter service flies to. So you can go from Penzance to Tresco and to St. Mary's. It's sort of a triangular sort of route.
And you can fly from Exeter and Newquay as well to St. Mary's Airport as well.
So yeah, and land, and you can fly by aircraft from Land's End as well.
I'm glad we cleared that up. So basically, in terms of either tourism today or in the military past, you could have flown a plane and landed on a couple of islands, basically.
Yeah, a smallish plane, yes.
All right, interesting. So basically, if you had taken the islands and you were a foreign power, you could have naval and air superiority quite quickly, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's exactly why the Isles of Scilly are so special, because England, and latterly Britain, recognised their strategic importance, and that's why they fortified them so regularly from the 16th century onwards.
Yes, and doesn't that also make them special in terms of a national military legacy?
Yes, absolutely. If you think about the size of the Isles of Scilly, it's like a medium-sized village, population 2,000, fairly small area, and yet you have layer upon layer of military heritage. Pretty well every generation from the middle of the 16th century to the Second World War has left behind some military heritage. And this is sort of unparalleled anywhere on the mainland.
That's amazing. So really, the islands are a microcosm of military history.
They absolutely are. And say with one or two exceptions, you can see every threat or perceived threat to England and Britain personified in the defences that you can find on the islands.
What defensive structures were built and where on the islands, Alan?
Well, the vast majority are on St. Mary's, the largest island and the strategically most important, because you can guard most effectively the calm water in the middle of the islands. And the other place where there are a significant number of military defences is on Tresco, although there is also on St. Martin's a telegraph station that dates from the Napoleonic period. But essentially, it's all focused on St. Mary's and Tresco.
How many defensive sites do the islands have in total?
Tresco has six, I think. It has a couple of 16th century forts, a 17th century one. It has remains of an naval air base and a couple of earthwork defences of the 17th century. St. Mary's is harder to quantify. Dozens, literally dozens, everything from small earthworks through sort of pillboxes and fortifications, a small castle, all the way up to the garrison walls, which are about 2.5 kilometres in length.
Why were there military sites on Tresco initially? I've been doing some reading, as you can probably tell. If St. Mary's was strategically more important?
The reason was the Killigrew family. The central government in London recognised in 1547 that they needed to defend the island. They'd been left out of the major programme of military defences that Henry VIII was undertaking a little bit earlier. So in 1547, they decide they must have defences. They assign money. They give money to John Killigrew, who described himself as Captain of Tresco. Whether that was an official title or not, I'm not sure. And of course, he came back and he spent the money on his own island, i.e. Tresco. And so he built two fortifications, the old blockhouse on one side of the island and King Charles Castle on the other. So, of course, he was keen on defending his island, if you like, rather than the islands as such. There's then a review of the defences, and they go, somebody comes down from London and goes, they're in the wrong place, should be on St. Mary's. And so the next money that's allocated to Scilly gets spent on building Harry's walls on St. Mary's.
I bet Killigrew was going, oh, I do apologise. I appear to have put them in the wrong place.
Well, I'm sure there was a bit of that.
It certainly sounds like it. But
if you can get away with it.
Yes. By the 1500s, then, there's quite a military presence sort of building up, at least in terms of fortifications.
Yes. Well, I'd say there's the two on Tresco, and then in 1551, they start to build Harry's Walls on St. Mary's, and that is built on the far side of the harbour, on the east side of the harbour, to protect the harbour. And they start to construct it in 1551, but within about a year, the money disappears. They've run out of money, which sounds horribly familiar to us these days, and they just abandon the work. And they literally just walk away, leaving this partly built defence. Then when they come back in the 1590s, because they want to improve the defences, they don't actually go back to Harry's Walls. Instead, they build a completely new fortification at Star Castle on the other side of the harbour in a much better location, higher up. So you've got better control of the approaches into the harbour.
And visiting Harry's Walls is amazing, actually. It is one of our sites. And you just see this exactly half-finished, foundations of this, what would have ended up if they had completed it, as a very substantial fortification. So there's an enormous amount of rock, and you can see the pointed star points of one side, but the back is just completely unbuilt. So you can clamber over these rocks, and you're walking on the foundations of what would have been a massive fortification. So really good to see it, and see the strategic position that they thought would be ideal at the time, but changed their mind.
Did these Harry's Walls, these unfinished walls, did they serve any defensive purpose then, or were they just sort of like a bit of an embarrassment, an abandoned project?
Well, what happened was the money's allocated in 1551 for this new fortification. What's interesting is that John Killigrew, I think it was his son in this case, another Killigrew, was given the money and a plan to build Harry's Walls. Now, this is really important because when you look at the defences on Tresco, they're just boxes. They're very old-fashioned. Harry's Walls, the design of it, is absolutely cutting-edge modern military technology. And this is because the plan was handed to a Killigrew to bring back from London and to apply in St. Mary's. The extraordinary thing is that Harry's Walls, an almost exact parallel for it, wait for this, is in Berwick-upon-Tweed, because the plan has also been devised in London and sent to the north of England. And Harry's Walls is absolutely cutting edge because the bastions at the corners of the front part overlook the harbour. They're partially constructed and they're very sort of acutely angled. And this is the absolute most modern technique of fortification construction that had been brought from Europe just 5 years earlier or thereabouts. So Harry's Walls is amazing because it's absolutely at the forefront of military technology. Now, the work stops after about a year because money has run out. But the local tradition was that Harry's Walls was built in the wrong place. Now, Star Castle on the other side of the harbour is in probably a better location. But the thing that was in the wrong place in documents is actually the fortifications on Tresco, because the Killigrews have spent the money there. It's not that Harry's Walls is in the wrong place. And if, in fact, you stand on the remains of these walls and imagine them being two stories high rather than just above foundation level, you actually can see the approaches from the far side of the island as well as the approach into the harbour. So Harry's Walls would have been quite a formidable fortification in a very good location if it had ever been completed.
Right, yes. And looking at it from the air, it's got an interesting arrangement. It almost looks like the bottom edge of two spears pointing diagonally outwards.
From a square central block. And what's interesting is that the plan, we have got the plan, it survives of the building. And then the interior was going to be divided up with timber walls into a number of rooms. And if you visit Harry's Walls today, a copy of that plan is on display. So you can actually see how the building in plan would have looked if it had ever been completed.
So it was basically going to be a fort.
Yes, it was a gun fort.
Right. Okay. And what we're left with is a series of foundations, effectively, and that's why it's called Harry's Walls. Okay, who's Harry?
Well, you see, that's a misnomer because Harry is, of course, Henry VIII.
Right,
but in fact, this work was undertaken under his son, or under the regents who are running the kingdom under his son, Edward VI.
So the military sites that we are left with, what periods do they span? We've touched on it briefly with who the threats were, but what were the wars?
Well, the earliest military site is actually in Old Town, St. Mary's, which you can't see much of, except from the road. There's a big lump to the one side of the what I would call the main road around St. Mary's. And that's the remains of a medieval castle called Enor Castle. There's nothing to see apart from this mound now with trees on it. But the things that survive date from the mid-16th century right through to the Second World War. And what you have is a big mid-16th century sort of building campaign. Then 1590s, they're building Star Castle, and the beginning, a few years later, of the garrison walls. And this is to defend the islands against the threat of Spain. And then we come through into the 18th century, where the garrison walls are extended, replacing earthworks that had been built during the Civil War to defend the garrison. And then through into the 19th century, where on St. Mary's you have some massive gun batteries, which were designed to deal with the threat of the French Navy coming to attack the islands, although they never did and were actually never thinking about doing it. And then through into the 20th century, where you have various defences, particularly a number of pillboxes around St. Mary's designed to defend the island in event of a German invasion.
Given the military infrastructure that existed up until the Second World War, which island would be best equipped militarily to defend against a landing?
That would be St. Mary's, because you've got fortifications all the way around the garrison. I should maybe explain what the garrison is. St. Mary's was effectively once two islands. There's the main part of the island, and then there's this other island called the garrison. And in between, a sandbank formed. And on that sandbank, Hugh Town was built. So St. Mary's today is a small island, a sandbank, and then the big island, if you like. Now, they're all linked as one thing today. If you go to St. Agnes, which is one of the islands that doesn't have any military defences, at low tide, it is linked to a smaller island called the Goo by a sandbank. If you go at high tide, the Goo is a separate island. And this is exactly a parallel of the arrangement that you had at St. Mary's, with the Goo, the small island, being the equivalent of the garrison at St. Mary's. So if you want to see how St. Mary's looked in the past, go to St. Agnes and you can see this sort of same geographical arrangement.
Okay. And just to situate people's minds, St. Agnes is southwest of St. Mary's. It's out towards the end of the archipelago, basically.
Yes, it's the last big one as you're heading out towards the Bishop Rock Lighthouse.
The garrison was always called the Hugh, wasn't it, Alan? That whole sort of peninsula. So it's an elongated peninsula. So wrapped around it is the garrison walls, which Alan mentioned is 2.5 kilometres long, which is a great walk. You know, it's just absolutely stunning. And you're going from bastion and bastion and gun platform to gun platform. Incredible. And right in the middle of that peninsula is the Star Castle, which is now a hotel, although expensive, very nice to stay in. But there you could stay, you know, back in this 16th century, superb star fort. You know, we were talking about these pointy bastions, you know, this top of the range military design of the time. And there you can see it in the Star Castle. But all around there, you can just see just wonderful examples of fortification design.
Yes, and as a rough summary, just to help people understand the picture, we're really talking about an island which is, imagine an oval shape, but then at the bottom left-hand side of the shape, you've sort of got a doorknob sticking out, and that is where most of the military history is situated, because it's on the edge of that sort of doorknob where you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 military sites that I can see identified by a certain search engine.
Sorry to correct you, but there are dozens of sites
circuit. I need to zoom in a bit more, perhaps, on this map.
Well, just to orientate you, if you come up from Hugh Town and you walk up towards Star Castle, you get to the gate into the garrison. And from the gate, if you go clockwise, there's literally two or three dozen gun batteries or firing positions or features as you go round on the circuit. Some of them have names named after people, and some of them are just Redan A, Redan B, and things like that, just a fortification position. And it is an extremely comprehensive set of fortifications. I say the first part where the gate is dates from around 1600, although the gate is actually a later rebuild. There was always a gate there, but the gate was rebuilt in 1742, which is the time that the main part of the garrison walls were being built. But you walk on a circuit and you're going from 1600, so you have pillboxes inserted into some of the earlier gun batteries. So you're going from 1600 all the way through to 1940s.
And as Alan and I were talking about it, this is probably the longest site in English heritage guardianship. So it's 2 kilometres plus of a walk around, you know, and you do go through all these different periods, these different styles of fortification around the peninsula. It's a great walk, even if you're just there for a day and you've, you know, flown in for the day. It's one of the best ways to see the defences, to tour around the garrison walls. And starting at that main gate, which is an 18th century gate, and just inside is the powder magazine, which is well worth seeing as well, which is part of our estate.
But broadly speaking, it's all concentrated in that bottom left-hand corner of St Mary's.
Yes, that's where most of it is, yes.
That makes absolutely perfect sense, because that would be your approach if you were an attacking force. So you certainly put it in the right place at that stage, Mr. Killigrew.
Killigrew had nothing to do with this one, thankfully, because Killigrew's focused on Tresco. So it's the Godolphin family who really run the islands. And so if you go to Star Castle or you look at the gate, you'll see people's initials, FG. There's an awful lot of Francis Godolphins who are in charge of the islands over the centuries.
And how well have these sites survived, given their coastal position, Wynne?
That's an interesting question, because, as you know, climate change is going to affect all of us, and it will affect English heritage sites in the future, particularly coastal ones. And we are quite concerned about a few of our sites, and the garrison walls are one of them. And we're going to be monitoring that and looking very hard at it in the coming years. But with sea level rise and the changes in weather patterns, apart from the sort of the threat of waves eating away at those defences, there's also, you know, the damper climate stuff that gets into ruins and tears them apart. So climate change is really going to affect our sites in the coming years, particularly the garrison walls. And it is big. It is over 2 kilometres of walls. So there's a lot to look after there. And you can see how close the sea is encroaching there, at particular points anyway. And I suppose, you know, the big philosophical questions are whether you abandoned it to the sea, or are there particular areas where you can spend some money and protect it for many years to come?
Well, on that subject, there are areas where the sea is getting very close, but there are a couple of areas where the sea has already impacted on the walls. And in the past, defences have been put in the form of sort of concrete sort of sandbags that are actually stopping some of the walls falling into the sea. But what we've not been able to do is to protect some of the 17th century earthworks along one side of the island, or along one side of the garrison, which are now falling into the sea. And English Heritage, about 20 years ago, actually undertook an excavation to record some of these earthworks, because we could see that they were going to fall into the sea at some point. And as I go back each year, I see more and more gradually the sea is eating away at the coast. But coastal erosion is obviously a bad thing, but it's not a new thing, because the reason the garrison walls exist is due to coastal erosion, believe it or not, because in the 17th century, a circuit of earthworks was built around the garrison to protect St. Mary's, to defend St. Mary's during the Civil War. By the 18th century, those same earthworks were beginning to fall into the sea. And in fact, there's correspondence about this in the 1730s. And that's why they decide they're going to build the garrison walls a little bit further inland, away from where the sea was impacting on the earthworks.
Which sites, Wynne, do English Heritage care for specifically?
Well, all the garrison walls, as I say, 2 kilometres of it. Harry's walls, we've already mentioned. And then over on Tresco, there's the old blockhouse. There's King Charles Fort on the top, King Charles Castle. And there's also Cromwell's Castle. I think Alan can probably tell you more about those. But that's our full set of fortifications that are in our guardianship, that are in our protection. But of course, there are lots of other sites, as Alan has alluded to, that are protected. They're scheduled monuments protected by Historic England. So they're scheduled monuments that are protected, but not in English Heritage guardianship. So we've kind of creamed off for English Heritage the ones that we're interpreting and protecting and that kind of thing, just a handful of them.
We've already talked about some of the conflicts, some of the potential enemies, but we'll look at the actual structures and what was happening at the time and what was being built. So could you give us, Alan, the earliest military sites and who was potentially going to launch an attack?
The earliest one is a small medieval castle, old town on St. Mary's, Enor Castle. And that's just a castle that was built for control of the island. I mean, there's no specific enemy reason for building that. But by the 16th century, with England breaking away from the church in Rome, there's a threat from the French and the Spanish. And so this is why money is put aside to build new fortifications. Firstly, on Tresco, the old blockhouse and King Charles Castle, and then latterly, Harry's Walls. That threat effectively fades away during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, but by the 1580s, there's a threat from Spain. We all know about the Spanish Armada of 1588, but there were various attempts by the Spanish to conquer England, and the Isles of Scilly for the Spanish were effectively in the front line, because although Spain is a long way away, around about 1590, Spain briefly controlled Brittany, and Brittany is about the nearest bit of France to the Isles of Scilly and Cornwall. And this is why Scilly at this point was really strategically important. We tend to think of our relationship to the continent as sort of the Dover to Calais sort of thing. But if you're in the Isles of Scilly, you're actually much closer to that bit of France than you are to Calais. And there was various threats. There was the Armada in 1588. There was reports of a large fleet perhaps coming to Scilly in 1587. And there was an actual landing in Cornwall in the 1590s. And so money was put aside, central government, to build a new fortification on the garrison called Star Castle, which is built between 1593 and 1594. And if you walk in through the door into the perimeter of Star Castle, you'll see the date, 1593. You'll also see two sets of initials, FG for Francis Godolphin, who was in charge of the islands at that date, and RA, which is Robert Adams, who was the engineer who was sent to build that fortification. And it's quite an impressive one. It had a series of positions for artillery and loops for muskets to fire through, so it would have been quite a formidable fortification in its day.
There was also, of course, the period where England is fighting against itself, the English Civil Wars of the 1600s. What was built in this period, Alan?
Well, what's very interesting is that the islands in 1646 are a refuge for Prince Charles, who had gone to be Charles II, who's fled from the mainland. He's briefly on the Isles of Scilly before he flees to Jersey and then onto the continent. And then from 1646 to 1648, the islands are in the hands of Parliament. And then they rebel against the governor in 1648 and become royalist. And they allow privateers to operate who are preying on English and Dutch shipping. And this is a problem because the Dutch become incensed that the ships are operating from Scilly attacking their sort of merchant fleet. And so they threaten to invade the islands. And so Parliament in 1651 creates a fleet and sends it to the Isles of Scilly to invade the islands. This is the one time the islands were invaded. And it's quite amusing because they arrive on the east side of Tresco and they land on what they think is Tresco, but they've landed on the wrong island at night. And they're actually fired on from the old blockhouse and they have to retreat. The next night they come back and they land actually on the right island. They land on Tresco this time, take the old blockhouse, march across the island to take King Charles Castle, and then head southwards to the bottom of Tresco where they can look over at St. Mary's. And at that point, near where you get the boat at low tide, to go between Tresco and St. Mary's, they built an earthwork fortification, mounted a couple of guns from ships, and started firing at St. Mary's. The only problem was, the first shot they fired from the gun blew up, killing the gun crew. But they then carried on firing, and St. Mary's surrendered within a few shots. And so, to improve the fortifications, they actually built a thing called Cromwell's Castle, down below King Charles Castle, between Tresco and the adjacent island of Bria. And it's a big, tall tower that had guns mounted on top of it to protect that sort of waterway. And so Parliament had taken the islands, 1651, reinstalled its own governor, and then, of course, with the restoration in 1660, it goes back to being part of the sort of the kingdom of King Charles II.
So if we had to summarise the Civil War history of the Scilly Isles, or the Isles of Scilly, I should say, it's only Tresco that really falls.
Tresco is the only place where there's active fighting, but there is a lot of construction work on St. Mary's building earthwork fortifications, which you can see round, some of them survive round the garrison, and they also survive in a few places round the larger island of St. Mary's, if you like, where there are specific sort of earthwork gun batteries at a number of locations.
And just looking at the map here at the moment, Cromwell's Castle is in the northwestern side, as you've described, yes, controlling that channel. So I can sort of see that there was a kind of strategic importance to that channel, but only if you're going to be using Tresco as a stepping stone to taking St. Mary's, which is to the southeast.
So, yes, well, St. Mary's, I think, by this time is fairly well fortified. And I think they just felt they wanted some added protection because that area of water between Tresco and Bria is nice and calm. So it's another place you can actually sort of moor ships safely.
Yes, and Bria is obviously to the immediate west of Tresco.
It's a wonderful castle to visit as well. Quite a lot of steps, but you get a terrific view from the top. And actually, if you've come across by boat from St. Mary's, it's, what, a 15-20 minute walk from the quayside, just a beautiful path along the shore of that very calm water.
If you're a fan of graffiti, there's some wonderful carved initials, not from vandals and hooligans, but from the gunners who actually were manning this fortification in the 18th century. And they've carved their initials and their dates on. And it's, you know, it's very evocative when you visit that building.
Let's talk about the Georgian period next. That saw a lot of building activity. What was going on to prompt construction and what was built in Scilly, Alan?
The story really revolves around two big European wars. There's the War of Spanish Succession in the 1710s, and following on from that, there's actually a review of the defences of the Isles of Scilly, and the earthwork fortifications that had been built during the Civil War are repaired, renewed, and improved. Fast forward about 20 years into the early sort of 1740s, you have the War of Austrian Succession, and this is effectively a European-wide war with various countries against various other countries. Very complicated to explain. But the Isles of Scilly was strategically important because its location between Britain and Ireland and controlling the waters that are going up the west side of England and Wales to Scotland, because the French are wanting to support the Jacobite Rebellion. And there's a fear even before that happens in 1745 that this would take place. And so the decision was taken due to the coastal erosion on the south side of the garrison that they will build a new sort of circuit of walls. The first section of the garrison walls had actually been built about 1600. And this was really on the section between Hugh Town and the garrison, but it's extended between 1741 and 1746 around most of the garrison. And what's interesting is when you visit St. Mary's and you walk up the hill towards Star Castle, you go through the gate that I've already mentioned. And the initials on it are, there's a date, 1742. There's the cipher of George II, G2R. But there's also initials FG, another Francis Godolphin, who was the governor of the islands at the time. But the biggest letters on the gate are AT. And this is for a man called Abraham Tovey, who is the master gunner. He's in charge of the construction of the garrison walls at the beginning in 1741. And he's a very interesting character. He'd been a soldier fighting in Spain during the War of Spanish Succession at the beginning of the 18th century. He then left Spain after the peace and arrived in the Isles of Scilly in 1714. And he starts the construction of the garrison walls in 1741 and goes clockwise round to where Woolpack Battery is at the south of the island. And he's promptly relieved in 1743 of responsibilities, probably because he's, how would one say this politely, had his fingers in the till. The government's given a lot of money and isn't entirely happy with the results. And instead, they send men from the mainland who take control of the construction program. And then they continue the construction round to a place called Stevel Point, where it stops literally abruptly. Just the wall ends. It was going to be extended further, but it stops. In 1746, all the money stops because of the Battle of Culloden. The Jacobites have been defeated. There's no longer any threat of the French supplying money to the Scots and arms and equipment. And so they stopped building the garrison walls.
In the 19th century, what sort of activity did the islands have then?
The threat of Napoleon and French invasion was obvious at the beginning of the 19th century. Most of the activity at that time is naval. But on the Isles of Scilly, there is one sort of gun position in King Charles Battery rather than castle. King Charles Battery is an earthwork battery on St. Mary's, and they built a new sort of gun position there for firing to protect the approaches to the harbour. But what you also have is they want to be able to communicate with the mainland. And so they build a telegraph station on St. Martin's, which is the closest, but that's the island that's closest at the north of the cluster of islands. And it has the point that's closest to the mainland. So they built a telegraph station. By telegraph, I mean sort of a semaphore shutter type of telegraph, not an electronic one. That is open for about 10 years, and then they build a new one on St. Mary's and a big cylindrical tower called Telegraph Tower, which sits in the main part of St. Mary's. But during the 19th century, there are threats to Britain, but there isn't much activity on the Isles of Scilly during the 1860s, where there's a lot of building work on the mainland. But there is in the 1890s, where they are fearful of the threat of France. And so they build two huge gun batteries, each with a pair of gun positions on the south end of the garrison. They build a smaller, what they call quick-firing battery, where there's a quick-firing gun close to those two large batteries. And then they build another one of those quick-firing gun positions at Bant's Carn, near where the Iron Age village is. And this is to counteract the threat of French major ships or fast-moving gunboats. And in support of this, they build a couple of what they call defense electric light positions, two little concrete positions that had searchlights as part of the sort of the infrastructure of defending the islands at the end of the 19th century.
After the threat of France had died down, how did the sites develop going into modern times?
Well, what's interesting is that they're building these huge sort of gun batteries at the end of the 19th century. They bring major guns from the mainland, they drag them all the way up the hill, they install them in the gun battery, and then in 1904, we've signed the Entente Cordiale with France. France is no longer the threat, it's Germany's the threat. So they have to take the guns all the way back down, put them on ships, and ship them to the east coast of England. And instead, they start to prepare for the threat of Germany. And once we're at war with Germany, in the First World War, they use St. Mary's in the later years of the war as a location for an air station, for naval aircraft. And they decide to build an air station at Porthmellon on St. Mary's. And they move in, they start to build sort of a concrete sort of base. They start to erect warehouses. The locals told them this was the wrong place to put it. If you land a flying boat there, the plane will be blown onto the rocks. The Navy was, yeah, we know what we're doing. We're not going to listen to you. They land, I think, three. They all get blown onto the rocks. And so they relocate the airbase to Tresco. And if you remember, I mentioned about the calm waters between Tresco and Bryre. They use that for landing these sort of seaplanes, flying boats. So these flying boats land there and they build a sort of naval airbase at Tresco near the harbour where visitors alight today.
So the calm waters become a landing strip, basically.
The seaplanes land there and are then towed up a concrete sort of ramp up onto the land. and then a collection of sort of old farm buildings adapted, and sort of new hangars and accommodation buildings are built. And today you get hints of that. There's still the concrete ramp up onto the land is still there. And if you look carefully, you can see the footings of some of the huts where the naval airmen used to live.
So that's a good question, actually, that leads us on to talking about personnel. Over the centuries, obviously there was a lot of building going on, but did the Isles of Scilly have a lot of military personnel stationed there ready for potential invasions?
Well, this is one of the problems. If you look at the garrison walls, there are potentially dozens, maybe 200 or 300 separate firing positions. You would never have been able to man it, except at the point of real threat when they would have brought in lots of, sort of troops to do this. So they were building fortifications that some of the trained locals would have used, but you would have always needed to bring in sort of large numbers of people from the mainland. And perhaps more importantly, as well as bringing in people, you would have to bring in food and all the provisions they would need and all the supplies they need, because the islands lived for most of their life on subsistence terms. So food and drink, if you like, all had to be brought with any troops that you're stationing there.
Lastly, the second major conflict of the 20th century, the Second World War. Can you describe how the Isles of Scilly, how they were used in that conflict?
Well, after the Channel Islands fell to the Germans, Churchill convened a war cabinet. And one of the items on the agenda was him saying the Isles of Scilly must be defended. We can't let them go. And the first thing they did was they put a destroyer into the calm waters in the middle of the islands, armed with anti-aircraft guns to act as a sort of temporary sort of defence. They stationed 6 Hurricanes at the airfield, and they set about building a series of pillboxes around St. Mary's, many of which survive, some of which are very obvious, some of which are disguised. There's one in Old Town that's disguised as a garden wall, and you can easily walk past it. The Isles of Scilly had radar stations. And if you go to the far side of the island from the main town, there's actually a big concrete arrow set into one of the cliff tops, because that was where they used to point aircraft for a bombing range for practicing sort of dropping bombs from the hurricanes. Needless to say, the Germans never came to the Isles of Scilly, and as with so many of the other defences, the soldiers went away and they just left behind the military structures they'd built.
There was, of course, something that we haven't mentioned so far. There was a conflict that took place, and it went on until 1986, but many of us wouldn't know about it, so tell us about that, Alan.
In 1651, the islands were proving a nuisance to the Dutch. Privateers were operating from the Isles of Scilly, attacking Dutch shipping. So the Dutch were ready to invade the islands. And briefly, Britain went to war with the Dutch, with the Netherlands. And that's 1651. Now, when we went to war, the declaration of war included mention of the Isles of Scilly. When the peace treaty was signed soon after, the clerk who wrote the peace agreement omitted the Isles of Scilly. So technically, the Isles of Scilly were still at war with the Netherlands from 1651 until somebody spotted this in 1985, and in fact a peace treaty was signed in 1986, ending over 335 years of war.
I bet that was a great local story for the local newspaper.
Any reason to publicise the islands.
Speaking of publicising the islands, what are the best ways to soak up the military history of the Isles of Scilly, Wynne, if you're a historian or just a history buff?
Well, my favourite way of getting around is on a bike. And of course, it's very sustainable. It's, saves all the fumes around the island, Well, there aren't many because it's such a beautiful environment. But there are buggies you can hire as well, a bit like golf buggies, as well as bikes. And you can hire a car if you must, or just walk. And that is the best way to soak it up. I mean, they are just so peaceful and really beautiful to explore. And as we mentioned, the wonderful flowers that you can see and the exotic planting or the exotic plants that have sort of wilded themselves across the island. And there are cafes, there are art galleries. So you can have a really sort of nice mixed experience. You don't have to go full speed ahead at your fortifications. You can mix it around a bit. And it's so relaxed. It's really nice. I sound like I'm working for the silly tourist authority, but you can't help but be touched by the magic of these lovely islands, actually, and explore all the history. I mean, there's so many places around the country where you go to visit fortifications, and they're not that pleasant sometimes, you know. But this is just sort of visiting military sites in paradise. Alan was saying when people were stationed there, they must have enjoyed it as well. I mean, it must have been one of the most wonderful places to be stationed, even if you were having to staff the guns. And the fact that it wasn't invaded, in a way, is a testament to the fact that they did their job properly, but they didn't actually get shot or hurt in any way. So they're blessed, those islands, I think.
And is it easy to island hop, to go from St. Mary's to Tresco to Bria to Sampson to all these different islands and experience them? Is it fairly easy to connect?
Yes, the main islands, you have to be careful that you get back to the ferry at the right time. Otherwise, you get stranded. But no, there's regular ferries between all the inhabited islands.
The best location to really operate from is St. Mary's, which is the biggest island, because from there, there are St. Mary's Boatman Association boats every day in the middle months of the year. They don't operate in the winter. But there's a regular boatmen's association from St. Mary's to each of the other islands, to St. Agnes, to Bria, to Tresco, and to St. Martin's. They also operate from time to time boats out to uninhabited islands, and been a few times on to Sampson, which was inhabited until the 19th century, but abandoned then. And you can still go into houses that were once people's homes 150 years ago. And just talking about the sort of the beauty of the place, wherever you go on the islands, I concentrate mostly on the military sites, but you just stand and you look out over this beautiful calm water, the beautiful beaches, wonderful sort of nature all around you. It's a beautiful place to visit.
As we conclude our conversation, what did the Isles of Scilly say to you when you visit them today? Apart from obviously the visual aesthetic and the sand in between your toes and the calm breeze and all that sort of stuff.
Well, for me, it's 2 weeks not sitting at my desk. It's 2 weeks of walking around, fresh air. I'm just thinking about that, and I just think it's my happy place. It's just somewhere I go to, and I just relax and shed all my troubles. I don't have to drive a car for 2 weeks. I'm more worried about whether I'll be able to book to get a lobster supper delivered. You know, it's that kind of a place, you know. And you know, where the next beer is at the Salonian Club. And so it's just a wonderful, relaxing place for a holiday.
For you, Wyn?
I agree. All those thoughts I echo. And the fact that you can actually spend some time doing some archaeology as well. As an archaeologist, I still feel that I can read the landscape and look at how things have changed. And visiting places like Hallangey Down, the ancient village, you know, you start to look at how those houses were used and during the Iron Age, and trying to understand the social network of the people that lived there is really interesting. And the other thing that fascinates me about Scilly is that it used to be one island back in prehistory. In fact, it was even part of the dry land of Europe, if you go right back to the last glacial maximum. But right up until the Iron Age, it was one island. And it's fascinating. I study place names, and I find that the place names, a mixture of Cornish and English place names, really tell you so much about what's been happening on the island. But, you know, right up to modern place names like Garrison, you know, that are fortification place names. But almost whatever you go into, you know, whether you look at the history of bluebells and daffodils or butterflies or something, or fortifications or prehistory, there's something for everybody there. And it's just so wonderful that English Heritage has this bunch of sites on St. Mary's and Tresco. It is a really good opportunity for people to go and find out about our history.
And it's interesting, as you say, that ancient climate change left the islands as a group of islands as opposed to one. What are the challenges going forward to preserve the history of the Isles of Scilly for modern times?
Well, they certainly are challenges. It depends how far you're looking into the future, but the predictions of sea level rise are a little bit scary for islands all around the world, actually. You know, if you go from the Pacific to the islands like Scilly. So it is something that we're going to have to be concerned about. Everybody needs to be concerned about it. In the shorter term, in the next decades, we are going to have to be very careful about how we manage our sites, particularly sites like the Garrison Walls that are right down on the water, some tough decisions might have to be made. But hopefully not. You know, hopefully we can maintain those the Garrison Walls in the way they have been for at least for a couple of hundred years anyway.
Anything you could add to that, Alan?
I started visiting the islands about 20 years ago, and some of the footpaths I walked on 20 years ago no longer exist. They're in the sea. That's the real-time experience, if you like. You know, I've actually seen sections of the cliff falling away and the new concrete sandbags having to be installed to stop the Garrison Walls falling into the sea. And so I'm no king canoe. I'm not going to attempt to hold back the sea, but there will come a point where it's not economically possible. It's not reasonable to spend money on protecting 18th century walls when people's homes are at risk. I dare say there'll be huge debates and arguments about that. But on the positive side about coastal erosion, you mentioned Halanji, the Iron Age village there. If you go down onto the beach below Halanji, coastal erosion is actually exposing things. And a few years ago, I was there when a Bronze Age pot appeared in the cliff. It had been set in the ground, and due to coastal erosion, it suddenly appeared, and it was very carefully excavated and taken away. And so over the years, I'm seeing archaeological features beginning to appear where coastal erosion has occurred. So although it's 99% a bad thing, coastal erosion, for heritage, there's a 1% sort of bonus where we're actually beginning to learn one or two things about the islands due to it.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll be back to chart 900 years of history at Furness Abbey in Cumbria.
The abbey is built in a distinctive red sandstone, and gosh, I've been there in all weathers, all times of the day, and they are at their best when they are catching the low sun.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.